Hey Trailblazers, this is Jason, your host of the Trailblazing Texas podcast. Before we jump into our latest episode, I've got some incredible news for you. Are you gearing up for your next big hike or backpacking trip? Well, we at Trailblazing Texas podcast have partnered up with Trekker Joe's, the ultimate Texas outfitter, to bring you something I feel absolutely special. Listeners, you of the Trailblazing Texas podcast can now get a one-time 15% off their gear purchases at Trekker Joe's. That's right. Whether you're a first-time customer at Trekker Joe's or a repeat customer like me, you can save big and hit the trails well-prepared. So upon checkout, use code TTP15 to claim your 15% discount and in the process support an amazing local Texas business. So happy trails, and don't forget to tell your hiking buddies. Now on with the episode. Welcome to the Trailblazing Texas podcast, where we embark on a journey through our diverse Texas landscapes and breathtaking trails while always engaging with our amazing Texas hiking community. So settle in, tighten up those bootlaces, and get ready for the thrilling tales awaiting for you on this episode. So being a guide for as long as you've been, have you ever experienced death on the mountain?
Yes. Both kind of directly and indirectly.
I think we talked about it a little bit before, but how, with the experiences that you've had, and then knowing every time you pull up to the trailhead or to the mountain, how do you, I guess, departmentalize that or deal with that? Knowing that, you know, what you're about to get into, again, you could have the best of everything, the greatest weather, and things can happen.
Yeah. So that's, you know, obviously one of the more difficult, like, questions, try and answer, but I think if you're really in the game, then, and you haven't sat down and really thought about that, what your answer is to that, then you're either lying to yourself or you're not really paying attention. But, you know, there's kind of two different ways of looking at it. You know, you've got your own personal, like, interaction with it, right? The risk that you're taking on, and that's going to come from, you know, just being out there, you know, whether you're guiding or not, right? But then you also have this, like you said, this, like, added responsibility when you're guiding of, like, okay, you know, I'm not going out there with, like, my hardcore buddy today who's, like, really heavily into this game like I am. This is, like, Joey from Missouri that, you know, his wife and kids bought him this vacation trip for his 40th or his 40th birthday or whatever, you know? So it's like, he's not there to, like, take these, you know, big risks, right? And you know, like, that is definitely, like, evolved over time. Like, as I've gotten older, I've become much more conservative, both myself and also, but and for sure with my guiding. Like I said before, I was quite a bit more aggressive when I first started, and, you know, like I said, I don't think that was helping anybody, you know, to be that way.
So what would you consider to be your most, I mean, I think the original question was your most dangerous route that you've guided, but it's all dangerous. And I don't want to say it's all equally as dangerous, but it kind of is. I mean, maybe there's some more technical aspects that could lean to danger, but instead of saying danger, let's just say brutal, and maybe that encompasses everything. But what do you think is your most brutal route that you've ever guided?
Well, anyone who's spent a lot of time in the mountains knows that it's not the difficulty of the route or how, like, it has nothing to do with, like, it could definitely have to do with the difficulty, but more times than not, it's the conditions that were present while you were on that route, right? So, like, two people climbing the same route, one in, you know, beautiful blue skies, 65 degrees and the other in like a full whiteout blizzard, you know, that's not the same. It's the same route, but it's not the same route, right?
Yeah.
My answer to that would definitely be just because I've spent more time on Mount Hood than any other mountain, it would be Mount Hood. Because I've seen it in every way, shape, or form that you can think of, anywhere from beautifully pleasant and, you know, no wind at all, no clouds in the sky, to like, you know, being in like a truly life-threatening storm.
It's funny, when I first started talking to John, you know, I think he even said like, oh, we should go do Mount Hood. And I'm like, yeah, okay. Having no idea what I'm saying okay to. And then I started looking at videos on YouTube. I'm like, oh, hell no.
Yeah.
There ain't no way in heck I'm going to do that. But yeah, I mean, I guess it's probably a lot different if you get there. But yeah, I was just like, oh my gosh. And then, of course, it comes with, when you start researching Hood, all the things that go along with that, and, you know, bad experiences and stuff. So I was like, oh my gosh, like, that's crazy.
Yeah, Hood gets really, really gnarly weather, and the barrier to entry is extremely low. So a lot of people find themselves pretty high up on the mountain that, if it were most other volcanoes or mountains of that size, they probably wouldn't have made it above treeline, you know, with their experience level and fitness level. But because they parked at, you know, treeline, they're now like really high up on a mountain in a couple hours. That's quite serious, you know? And so it's just, like I said, it's a low barrier of entry, and it's just really easy to get to, you know?
And when you start on Hood, is it like crampons and ice axes just going up, or is there like some, not flat areas, but where maybe like on Rainier, there's some switchbacks to get up?
It's almost an ever steepening like cone, right? So like literally like it just, as you go higher, it gets steeper, and then it kind of finishes with like, you know, some pretty steep kind of real exposure in the last 1,000 feet. It's, you know, kind of fall and bad things will happen or you may die type of terrain.
Yeah. Golly. So have you ever been on the mountain and experienced changing conditions that became life-threatening?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, it almost, that happens most of the time, I would say, in some way, shape, or form. Yeah. You know, there's usually something that's going on when you're in the mountains that you need to be aware, like you need to be on the lookout for, right? Like, I would say that happens most days, you know, like whether it's, you know, like this face over here is in direct sun and there's going to be rocks falling down it, or like, you know, the snow over on this aspect is unstable, or, you know, this snow bridge that I crossed last week is not as stable and strong as it was last week. So I don't know how that's going to look, you know, so you're like, your engagement with like ever changing conditions should be like really high, you know, like you should be paying attention.
So this is probably a really stupid question. How do you manage all that experience?
Yeah, I would say it's experience. You know, you're kind of just like it's like, I don't know. You're kind of like being a detective, you know, you know, like, categorically the different types of hazards and things that are, you know, potential hazards out there. And then you're just looking for like the signs of those things while you're out there, you know, and then you've got, you know, your physical capabilities and your client's physical capabilities and, you know, whatever situation that you find yourself in terms of like, what's your gear situation? What's your, you know, your client's skill level, what's your skill level, you know, like, and so it is a complex thing, but yeah, you just kind of, you're definitely not just like moseying up the hill with your head down when you're guiding. That's for sure. I think that happens sometimes, unfortunately, but you shouldn't be.
So do you think guides have the potential? I mean, it's got to be yes, because even in rock climbing, the belayer probably is at fault a lot of the time with mishaps, or maybe even both climbers where they didn't check. Is there an end knot in the rope? Or so do you think that this also impacts guides, just complacency, or the mountain is so intense that you guys are just hyper focused every trip?
No, I would say that complacency in guiding is a very real, very common issue. Any guide that has been guiding for very long and says that that's not something that they interact with is either has a really high level of like focus or is not being entirely truthful. But, with guiding, it's like you're often doing the same route that you've guided, either like literally last night in the sense of like Mount Hood, like I would guide that, two, three, sometimes even 4 days a week, like summit climbs. So in that amount of time, as long as the weather hasn't changed, the conditions are exactly the same as they were pretty much, as they were yesterday. There's a new set of circumstances, right? Like new set of clients, new set of other climbers on the mountain. You might be feeling a little different today than you were yesterday. But so what I would say is really the more hazardous days come from these days where it's like you're complacent, like you don't expect anything crazy to happen, right? Because you're really familiar with the route, you've done it, 100 times, and you're just going up for another lap, right? Whereas when you're guiding something that's is physically demanding or technically demanding or both, you're going into that probably not with a client that you've never met. Sometimes people do that and it just drives me crazy. You're probably not with a client you've never met. You probably did your homework, and you're just generally hyper aware in that situation, right? It's the real deal. And so you're giving the mountain, hopefully, all the respect that it deserves. Whereas, when you're just pounding out laps in a guiding setting, I think complacency can definitely become a major issue.
So if you're taking me up on Hood and we get to the steep part, you and I are tied in together?
Yeah. So any time that you are at risk of either falling off or into the mountain, so, you could fall into a crevasse or you could fall down a slope or off a cliff, you should be tied into a rope. Okay. It's not 100% all the time. There are some appropriate situations where I have coached a client through a section where it was consequential. They did actually need to move on their own safely through that terrain or else there would be consequences. And so usually that takes the form of coaching and also what's the word I'm looking for? Demoing, I guess is the word, but showing them and then coaching them as they come across. But yeah, guiding, there's, a few different types of, ways you're going to use the rope. Most climbers are going to be familiar with long roping. That's the typical, glacier travel situation for protection falling in the mountain. That's the same as it always, as ever with guiding. The other thing that folks are typically savvy to or privy to is pitched climbing. So, I'm going to make an anchor here. I'm going to travel up this route, placing gear along the way. I'm going to make an anchor at the top. I'll bring you up to that anchor, right? The thing that you do a lot of in guiding that you never do in recreational climbing is short roping. So imagine kind of how you would walk a dog that wants to pull away from you and chase after everything. That's short roping. So you're like, you know, you're maybe 3 or 4 feet. Your hand is like 3 or 4 feet from their knot, and you're moving together. And you, literally, it's your physical person that's going to catch them if they slip.
So if we were going up, let's say we're on Hood and it's the steep part, would you go up first, set an anchor, and then bring me up, or we would be going up together? Like, how does that work? I'm just thinking, like, if I slip, like, how are you going to know that I slip so you can be prepared for that?
Yeah.
That pop in the line.
It's a really difficult skill set to learn. It's really difficult to master, but I'm typically like, I've got the rope real tight, and I'm usually like looking up at where I'm going and what I'm doing, but I can like, I'm using like my ear usually to be able to tell kind of like, what's your breathing sound like? Do you sound nervous? How do your crampons sound on the snow and ice? Like, is it steady? Is it like scratchy? You know, like if I hear like, you know, there's like the clang of like metal, like every guide has a near heart attack when they hear like something fall on snow, because they know that's like go time, right? So yeah, I would say that I'm typically using kind of like my feel of the rope, right? I'm kind of like pulling on you just a little bit. If it's real, if it's like, hey, we're in like real, you know, terrain, I'm going to have the rope real tight. So there's no slack. So there's no extra force that's going to be applied to me if you fall, right? And so I'm using that rope to kind of feel how you're moving. And then I'm also listening to how you're breathing, how you're moving, all that. And I'm typically not looking at you. I might look at you from time to time to actually visually confirm that you're doing the thing you need to be doing. But otherwise, I'm looking at where I'm going and what I need to do and what's going on with the mountain above. And so, yeah, like you just kind of you're climbing in such a way that you're always kind of like ready to catch a fall at a moment's notice. So the reason it doesn't really exist in recreational climbing is, well, A, you haven't typically been trained in how to do it, professionally trained how to do that. The other thing is that in recreational climbing, it's less common for the two people or three people on a climbing team to have such wide gaps in their abilities, right? So typically, like if me and my buddy are out climbing, we're probably pretty similar in our skill sets, right? So it wouldn't make a whole lot of sense for him to short rope me or me to short rope him. It's actually more dangerous than just climbing without a rope. So real funny, one of my coworkers, I overheard his client ask him something about like Alex Honnold and, you know, like the Free Solo movie that came out and everything like that. And he's like, yeah, you want to know something more dangerous than free soloing? And she was like, yeah, what? And he was like, short roping three clients on 55 degree ice, you know, because it's like you're essentially free soloing. There's no anchor above you, but, you know, you're responsible for holding everyone if people were to slip. So, yeah, that one is, unless you've been guided before, you're probably like haven't been exposed to being short roped or even the concept of it. But yeah, that one's unique to guiding.
So if you look over your whole career guiding, was there is there any single trip that kind of comes to mind that like tested you the most?
I would say, you know, it was probably actually my capstone climb. Like I kind of like planned this trip to Peru for right after I finished my Alpine exam. So like I essentially like came out of the Alpine exam, which was I think like 7 days or 8 days, or I forget how many days the Alpine exam was, but pretty full on days, you know, pretty stressful situation. And then I planned this trip to go to Peru with my buddy, and it was like I think I like got on a plane like 2 days after the exam ended and flew down to Peru, and we were down there like really late in the season. So like the season was over for all intents and purposes, right? So we get down there, all the climbers were gone, you know, the hostel was empty, and the hut keeper at the hostel was like, yeah, the climbing season's over. What are you guys going to climb? And I was like, well, what's possible? And, you know, she's like, well, you know, maybe this, but I don't know. Last people went up there said it wasn't even good anymore, but they seemed pretty new to the area. And I was like, well, sure, let's go for that. And so we decided to go for this climb that was like 20,000 feet. The only downside was there was a storm coming in at the end of the week, a large storm, like end of the season in Peru. It pretty much just snows and rains in the mountains for like 4 or 5 months without any breaks, right? Once the season ends. And so I was acclimated to like sea level. My buddy was coming from Colorado, so he was at least acclimated to like 7,000, 8,000 feet. And so we get there, we take our bus into Baraz, which is like the highest town there near the climb. And we slept in Baraz, which is at 10,000 feet that night. And then the following day we hiked up to, I want to say it was like 13 or 14,000 feet, and then came back down to Baraz and did some shopping and planning for the trip. And then we hiked up to like 15,000 feet the next day, and then came back down, packed, did our final packing, woke up the next day. And then we went up to base camp for this climb, which was at 15,000 feet. And we only had like 2 days before the weather came in from that point on. And so literally we just had to like 1 day climb, you know, we had like 1 day to do this climb and very much not acclimated. So, you know, even the porter was like, you know, he was like, well, what are you going to climb? You know, in broken English. And I pointed at the mountain. He's like, oh no, that's not like possible, you know? And we're like, well, we're just going to give it a shot. And so, we woke up the next morning and climbed it. And I wouldn't say that it was like advisable. This was like a pretty aggressive move, but you know, I've been through a lot with this person that I was climbing with. And, I just had faith that I knew him as a person enough, and I trusted my guiding ability enough, that we were going to like at least have like a safe experience that was like, you know, in control. And so, but we sent it, we like climbed to the top and summited in extraordinary fashion. We actually owe it a lot to a coworker, a guide buddy of mine who I didn't even know was in Peru. And he was on his way out and we were on our way in. And he was like, we saw each other on the trail and he was like, Brandon? And I was like, Razor? And we just, he was like, what are you guys doing? And I was like, well, we're going to give this thing a shot tomorrow. And he's like, well, shit, like, he just dropped his bags, ran down to town, shopped for another night's or another day's worth of food, and then came back up.
No way.
He's like the fittest person I've ever met. But he came back up to camp. And then the next morning we climbed this thing and we totally needed him because, like, you know, right around like, I want to say like 17,000 feet, it was like really like gnarly post-holing. You know, just the moving was slow and I was very not acclimated. I was pretty like worked. But just having him there to like trade out with, and he broke a lot of trail because he was acclimated. He'd been up there for like a week. But he didn't want to tackle that mountain because he was by himself. But anyway, that's the long story of the Tokelarahu mission.
So y'all all got to the top?
We made it. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was gnarly.
So would you say that's your most extreme route that you've ever guided or sent?
Yeah, to be honest, you know, and again, it's like, it's not really that glorious on paper. Like if you look in a guidebook, you'd be like, oh, that's the hardest route you've ever climbed. But like, you know, if you go there in October, and you try and climb Tokelarahu in October, it's pretty damn hard. You know, it's like,
yeah.
it's like full vertical ice climbing in places. The ice is really rotten. You don't get good ice screws. The snow is really steep. Lots of snow bridges have collapsed. The route finding is difficult. Like, there are a lot of things conspiring against you if you're climbing a mountain not in prime season. And so, like, you know, I actually kind of like climbing easier routes in more challenging conditions than like chasing like the glory of like the what the guidebook says, you know, in terms of.
Well, I can tell you on the Trailblazing Texas podcast, that is the most epic badass route ever.
Yeah.
So it can't be the route you just described. What is another once in a lifetime mountaineering moment that you've had that you'll never forget?
Oof. Man, I want to say I mentioned this earlier, so I don't want to say I don't want to say that one again. Man, they're all like, I remember many of them. That's a really difficult question to answer. I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. You know?
What about, is there one that you remember that got to you in a way that, oh man, this really could have went sideways quick?
Yeah. Again, a lot of them have gone like that. I would say there's just been a few moments kind of like when the time when I was climbing there, guiding the Inspiration Traverse, or Isolation Traverse rather, with John, there's been a decent amount of moments where you kind of know that there's no going back. Like, it's probably been like a dozen times in my career or so where like, I know that we are 100% committed at this point. Like, I'm not going to be able to like pull the plug on this and easily get us out of this situation. Right. Like, we are really doing it, you know? Whereas, you know, most routes that I have guided, you can just be like, oh, you're not feeling good. Cool. Let's just walk back down, or let's just, you know, clip into this anchor and we'll just rappel down and be out of this. Right.
Yeah.
But it's every time that you like, as a guide, you know that there's like no easy way out of this situation now. And like, this is one of the things that I really struggled with for the last few years with guiding is like, I think it must just be because I've gotten older and in some ways wiser. I've seen the accidents and I've been in the game long enough now to like, you know, have experienced seeing accidents, hearing about lots of accidents, all this stuff that can go wrong. And it happens at like a really personal level. So it's like really like, there's no question that I'm like getting it. Like, it's right in front of my face. Right. Whereas when my clients are with me, like, I tell them, hey, this is a risky activity, right? They sign a waiver that says like, hey, you might get hit by a rock. You might get avalanched. You might get hypothermia. You might fall off a cliff. There's a lot of different things that you sign off on when you sign that waiver. But I would say most of them don't actually think that is a possible thing that can happen.
Well, I would say that everybody that, like, if I just think of hiking and backpacking, I don't know that there's probably one person that steps on the trail on a normal flat trail and think that there would anything bad happens. And it happens all the time.
Yeah. And it's always like the times when you don't expect it, but it's like, I guess where I was going with that is like when you are in that moment in guiding where it's like, okay, I can't get us out of this easily now. Like, we just pulled the rope. I can't just return the way we came now. Like, we need to go this way now. Right. And we are in this together because that's what we have to do now. There's like a weird feeling of like, man, I hope that they really understand this is actually real. And I'm not like I'm going to manage it the best I possibly can with my skill set. We are really in it now, you know? And I struggled with that the last few years that I've been guiding, where it's like, because they haven't been exposed so directly to the outcomes of these tragedies, do they actually know the seriousness of the place that they're in now?
Yeah. Wow.
You know, it's like, it's a trip for sure.
Can you, as a guide, limit the clients that you take into those kind of situations? Like, you got to trust that person.
Yeah. So I would say, unfortunately, it's not like an industry standard by any stretch. There are very, very few industry standards, unfortunately. You'd be very surprised with how loose the professional American guiding industry actually is. And I'm not talking down on the American guiding industry necessarily. Like, there's extremely talented, extremely gifted guides in the community. No, when it comes to like vetting, you know, if you're, say you're a guide and you're like, I need to work, right? Well, you're kind of going to take what work is offered to you, right? And if an employer says, well, if you'd like to work this weekend, I have work for you. It's this client you've never met before, and their son that you've never met before, and you're going to climb this route. It's out of your hands, really, as the guide. Like, the trip's been sold, right? So the vetting has happened, hopefully, in the office, right, over a conversation. And I think that there are times for sure when people have like overstated what they have done in the past and gotten onto trips where they like really kind of weren't supposed to be. But yeah, like I decide, like, once I kind of broke free from like needing to take every single trip that was offered to me, I pretty much categorically would only climb like really easy routes. Like, I haven't guided a difficult route with clients I've never worked with before in a long time.
No.
Because I just kind of like was like, this is not appropriate. Like, this, like, sometimes it works out just fine. Like, I had plenty of trips where it was like, okay, this is real climbing. This is like serious terrain. And I hope this person got vetted and they turned out to be like, yeah, appropriate for the terrain, or they weren't. And it came out pretty quickly that they weren't in a place that they should be in. And I was able to be like, hey, you know, like, this actually isn't going to work out. Maybe we climb this over here instead, you know? But yeah, luckily I was fortunate enough that with my credentials and experience, I was able to like turn down certain things and like, you know, yeah.
I would be checking their Instagram or Facebook to see, okay, what is this guy really doing?
Yeah. Unfortunately, you don't have time for it. You know,
like, where's that TikTok account?
Yeah. I don't think I've ever stalked, a client before the trip. Has this person actually like been doing things? You know, I feel like you get really good at meeting somebody and assessing them. I don't want to say judge them, but like, you definitely assess them quickly.
Oh, absolutely.
And I think that like, when you're like guiding on Hood in particular, like the number of clients, like you're climbing every single night, right? Boom, 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 with different clients. And so like, you get really good, really quick at like being like, hi, nice to meet you. And just like immediately you're like assessing them as a human. Like, is this person going to like be all right when shit hits the fan tonight? You know?
So when you're on Hood and you first start, is it crampons immediately, or is it, there will be a point where everybody needs to put on the crampons?
It depends. As with all mountains, like, you know, where you put on crampons last week is not the same, but you know, if it's really firm, you might be crampons immediately, you know? Just because the snow is like completely frozen and smooth, and so you don't have any traction at all. So at night when it's cold and dark, you're climbing what's called neve, which is just frozen snow. for all intents and purposes, it's ice, you know.
So have you ever been in a situation where the guy like talked a big game, and then when you get kind of on the mountain, he kind of asks like a really stupid question, like, how do you put crampons on, or how do you tie this? Or
I would say most of the time, like, there's a direct correlation between like how much of a big game they talk and how unprepared they are.
Really?
It's usually like the real quiet, reserved people who are just like nodding their head every time you say something to them, you know, and not really like, they're just, you can tell they're just absorbing the information and they're like there to learn. They do just fine, you know. It's the guys who are like, oh yeah, I bet, you know, I bet on Rainier, it was like so easy, you know, and then they like get into like, you know, a steep part of Mount Hood and they're like, oh my goodness, this is really steep, right? Because they just walked on 2 feet up to the summit of Rainier. And right. Now they're like, you know, holding on to an ice axe on, you know, frozen neve. And they look down and it's just like 1,000 feet of exposure. You know, like that's a new experience for them. You know, it's like, it's funny how many people, this is another one that you get a lot of in guiding. There's a misconception that like there's a correlation between height, like the elevation of a mountain, and difficulty. Yeah. You'd be surprised how many people are just like, oh, that mountain's only 9,000 feet. It can't be that difficult, right? Mount Everest is 29,000 feet. But like the funny thing is like the mountains on either side of Everest are like more difficult.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, it's like, there's a lot of misconceptions.
So speaking of like the class that you got your license, what all did you have to do with that?
Well, it's like a typically
practical, and then like you're actually on a mountain doing the stuff, or is it all like, you know, paper tests and stuff like that?
So in my experience, it was all practical. So there were I have heard of like, you know, weather being so like ridiculously atrocious that like, you know, you might spend a day like taking an exam on, you know, like a written exam on like radio frequency, you know, how radio usage and stuff like that. But like, for the most part, the AMGA mountain guide track is a completely practical, well, I shouldn't say that. It's there's outside of like the AMGA specific courses, there's other things that you need to do. So like, for instance, like you have like a medical certification you have to maintain. And that has a pretty, it's probably half in the book, right? And then there's also like your avalanche education, which as a mountain guide level, you know, is quite extensive. And then a lot of that is on book two. But in terms of like the AMGA's mountain guide program, so like the rock courses and exams, the alpine and the ski courses and exams, and the ice course, it's all just like you're in the mountains, in the terrain, either learning how to manage it and guide it, or you're being examined on how well you do that and accomplish, you know, the different kind of categories of what makes good guiding.
Wow. So that sounds like a really tough experience.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, again, just like all things, it's very conditions dependent.
Yeah. So have you ever been either with friends or with clients where you've had to deal with equipment failures on the mountain?
Yeah, for sure. It's not super common, and I always have a repair kit. So I've fixed a lot of things like just on the fly, and like the clients are always like, whoa, you fixed that. Or like, you know, I'll like somebody like will tear something and like, I'll be like, hey, like at the next break, like hand me that jacket, you know? And then I like sew it for them and they'll be like, you know how to sew? And it's like, yeah, I know how to sew. Like, what do you think? Like, of course I know how to sew. But then you have like more. So like one that comes to mind, I was guiding this group of ladies from Mexico, and like they were just a crazy group that, you know, was there to have a bunch of fun. And, you know, they just chose a mountain to climb, and they chose Mount Baker. And so we're climbing Mount Baker, and there were like differing levels in the group of like experience and comfort levels. And one of the women, she had borrowed this old pair of plastic mountaineering boots from a friend, and they had just been sitting for so long in like some, I don't know if it was like an environmental thing or if it was just actual like time, you know, that it like degraded over time, but like literally the boots were just like disintegrating. Right. They were like fully disintegrating. And so we're only like halfway up to camp. And so I like MacGyvered her boot together with all my like straps and gadgets, you know, just so she could get to camp. And then I told the other guides, I was like, hey, I have to go back down to town to like get a new pair of boots. So like, I just took it as like a fitness lap to like run back down the trail, you know, run back down the trail. I think I actually went to camp first, dropped off my bag, and then I like ran back down the trail. Another person drove the boots up from town, and I like ran back up to high camp and delivered a fresh pair of boots for her. But you know, things like boots, that's just like mission critical, you know?
Yeah. And is there like one piece of gear failure that you could say happens more often than not, or is it kind of just random?
I would just say that it's usually like something that people haven't tested, right? They don't know how it's going to perform, because it's like, you know, on an average mountaineering, like a guided trip in the mountains, the clients, I would say 99% of the clients are on their first mountaineering experience. You know?
Yeah.
And so literally their whole kit is untested. Right. And so they're going to learn a lot about their gear that, you know, in a short period of time. And it's usually like boot fit and stuff like that. There's like, I don't know. I'm definitely like a boots super loose type of person. I don't know. You probably have your own way, you know, with mountaineer, with hiking boots. Like, are you a loose fit or a tight fit?
I'm about at least a half of a size bigger.
Okay, so like then you're like a half a size bigger than your street shoe.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'm like, my mountain boots are probably two sizes too big.
Really?
Yeah. I have a pair of mountain boots that are like tighter that I'll wear for like really technical climbing if there's going to be a lot of rock and ice. But if it's like a glacier, for the most part, even if it's like a little bit of ice, my boots are like barely on.
Really? Now I could see, and I was about to ask you, like, for the technical stuff, I would think that you would want it kind of like a glove, because you want to feel you going into the ice. But yeah, I mean, I could see glacier travel where, you know, it's probably makes sense to have a looser fit.
Here's an interesting one for you. You should try this out. So you're probably actually hiking in like trail runners at this point. Yeah.
I have 7 pair right over here.
Yeah. You probably have boots though, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I never untie my boots ever. Like, I literally like found the fit that I like, and then I just double knot that thing and pull it as hard tight as I possibly can. And what I do is like on my mountain boots, it's like, you know how like there's like the eyelets that you never like unthread, but then there's like the hooks on the sides.
Right.
I essentially, if I'm just walking, I will like just twist and like hook just the bottom two hooks.
Yeah.
But then if I'm getting into gnarlier terrain, I'll reach down and I'll pull the knot up so it tightens it, and then I'll just twist it and then hook the last two.
Wow.
So then it's like tight. So if I'm going to, like, if I'm just hiking, my boot is really loose, you know, but I never untie it. It's like the knot is always there. But then, like, if I'm about to, like, short rope or something, I'll just reach down and, like, pull it tight and twist it one more time and get that last, the top loops, the top hooks on the sides. It's just a trick that I, like, always did. I think it might have even started because my knot was frozen or something like that.
Yeah.
And it just, like, happened out of necessity. And then I just, like, was like, oh, that's cool. I'm just going to keep doing this. But I, like, have, like, boots that I've, like, guided in for, I don't know, 3 years. They usually last about 3 years, and I've never untied it. Not once. The knot that I put in the very first time is the knot that's been there the whole time.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
But also, you know, like, for me, the outside of that's really cool, I immediately thought of, like, that I can remember the time that I tied that knot and, like, the traverse that you were doing, and it's like memories and, you know, something like that. Yeah. Or I couldn't untie it.
Yeah.
So I think we kind of talked about this a little bit. The question is, what's one climb that you thought that you completed and you kind of looked back and go, man, I can't believe we made it. And I think we kind of touched on that. And so I'm going to modify the question a bit. When you and John finished the isolation traverse, did that, I can't believe we made it, pop in your head?
For sure. I mean, it was never I guess it was never close enough to where I was like, I can't believe we made it. Right. Mm-hmm. But I, for sure, once we were like back down to the trail and everything was clearly like we were going to get out to the car just fine and everything, I was like, whew, that was a whole lot more than like we bargained for. Definitely more than Megan bargained for, you know, and like, you know.
If I asked her that question, she'd say, heck yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know that she talked to John the whole way home.
Yeah. I mean, that was the first time I've ever made a fire for the purposes of like, we need to like dry our clothes and stay warm.
No. Didn't y'all run into some people where a girl was like into hypothermia?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like there was a group of, I don't remember.
Yeah. We helped them as best we could, but we also like needed to like keep ourselves moving too. So like,
yeah,
you know, it's always weird. Like when you're guiding and like another group is having some sort of an issue that like clearly you could like help them with, but like you're with these clients that are like paying for your like direct attention to them. Right. Like when I'm guiding, like if I'm guiding you on Hood, like I'm figuring out what's going on with Mount Hood. And then I'm like taking care of you and me. Right.
Yeah.
But if like that person over there is about to fall, like if you're in a safe spot, I might be like, hey, just hang out here for a second, you know? But then there's like also this risk of like, if you're going to need me at all for like, to like get out of the mountain safely, like I may not even go and help because like, what if I go over there and help that person and then like something happens and I get swept away? Well, now like I just like totally abandon you on the mountain, right? So I typically will like ask my clients what they want me to do, you know?
Yeah, and that's a really okay. So I think in the first of our episodes, I love hiking and backpacking, but I'm infatuated with mountaineering. Every book I have on Audible is about mountaineering. Every documentary I watch is about mountaineering. I just love it. I could sit here and talk to you for 48 hours nonstop. I just love it. And there's always, I don't know if it's an argument, but there's always a controversy, you know, when you look at K2, Everest, some of these places where people are dying and people just kind of walk right by them. And because if they can't help or they're going to die. And, you know, you always kind of, I mean, I'm glad you kind of brought that up. What do you feel your responsibility is as a guide? I mean, I guess it's not like the, you know, as you're a doctor, you know, you sign a what is that, that oath where you have to help?
Hippocratic oath, is that what it's called?
Yeah, yeah. And so that's really put you into a tough situation. Golly.
Yeah, yeah. I would just say that my responsibility is to my client. You know, and I've definitely been in lots of those situations where it's like, those people really need my help. Like, I could get them out of that situation, but like, I have to 100%, I have to take care of my clients. I have to make sure that they're like, I'm not going to put myself in a situation where I might be removed permanently from their situation, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So I take very few risks for others when I'm guiding. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So have you ever had I guess it's 1963 Everest story when the U.S. had an expedition. And so, you know, the goal was, and it's really interesting. I don't remember the name of the documentary, and I even have the book. But, you know, the goal was that they were, was to climb Everest. And so there were two sides. There were the guys who wanted to do, I guess, the South Col or the, I don't remember, the route that's already been climbed. And then there was a group of them that wanted to go on the North Face and do something that I don't believe at the time has ever been done. And I don't remember the gentleman's name, but I, of course, now when I'm talking about, I can't remember his name. Is it Hornsby?
Just like a Whitaker expedition.
Yeah. So it was that expedition. But there was a second group that summited Everest, and, so the original plan, you know, Whitaker, they summited, and then, the second group got to go on the North Face of Everest, and they made it, but they spent the longest, night out or time on the mountain.
They were like out in the open, like overnight.
Yeah, out in the open. Oh, yeah. And they said if there were, and it was overnight. And at that time, I think it was the longest at over, you know, 27,000 feet or where they were at. And they said that if it was just a little breeze that night, they would have all died, but ended up being a very peaceful night and they somehow made it. But have you ever had any unplanned overnight experiences on the mountain with clients or with your friends?
No, I would say I've never like had an unplanned overnight with clients. But I have camped in places I didn't intend to camp. There was one time when I was on a personal trip where my partner and I came down in the dark, and this was before like GPS days. This was not a guided trip. It was just me and a friend. But we came down in the dark before GPS days. And so we didn't know, we couldn't find our tent in the dark. It was just like, you know, it was in the forest and we like, you know, were new to the area. So we ended up sleeping on a rock overnight, and we like woke up in the, well, kind of woke up in the morning, but like our tent was like 200 feet away.
Oh my god.
We were so close, but we like couldn't find it and we were so exhausted. But yeah, I've in guiding, I would say I've just not made it to, like, didn't camp where I anticipated, right?
Yeah,
it's like, oh yep, I planned on being in this location, but looks like we're here for the night, let's set up. I've never been with my day pack and been like, we don't have a tent or sleeping bag. Yeah. And like, we're just going to like sleep here. No, not yet.
Have you ever watched the documentary, The Alpinist?
Yeah.
That's pretty intense.
2 years ago, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's the scariest weather shift you've ever experienced on the mountain while guiding?
And that wraps up another exciting episode of the Trailblazing Texas podcast.
We hope you enjoyed the episode today and stay tuned for our next episode where we will pick back up where we left off and guarantee to uncover many more hiking gems and share many more tips to enhance your experience on the trail. Until then, happy trails and happy hiking.